Welcome back to Neutrality Studies, and today it's my great pleasure and honor to have with me for the first time Ali Abu Nima. Ali is a co-founder of the news outlet Electronic Intifada. He's a journalist and a human rights activist for the Palestinian cause. Ali, welcome.
Thank you, Pascal. I've enjoyed your very thoughtful discussions and interviews for a couple of years, so it's my honor to be on your program.
Thank you very much. I mean, that's a great honor to hear that. And, you know, you've been one of the people who has been speaking out now for a long time for the rights of the Palestinians, but also for peace in West Asia. You've been demonized for that. And I would like to start with something that I couldn't believe when it happened, when I read about it. I was coincidentally actually in Switzerland when you were in Switzerland and you were arrested in Zurich on the streets. You were dragged by plainclothes police officers into a van and you were disappeared for the entire weekend. And you actually recently won quite an important court battle about this. Could you maybe give us the story in a nutshell and how it developed until now?
Yeah, so this happened really exactly a year ago. As we're recording this, it's January 21, but it happened, the saga began on January 24th of 2025. I'd been invited to Zurich by a group of Swiss citizens and residents to come and speak at an event they hold regularly to discuss particularly Palestine. Their activists, academics, not a major group. And I suspect that if I had gone and given my talk and taken part in the discussion, very few people would have known about it, and perhaps there would have been 30 or 40 people there. But instead, it turned into a strange international saga. And so I arrived in Switzerland on January 24th of 2025. I entered through Zurich Airport. There was a short delay, which had nothing to do with Switzerland, but had to do with the fact that I and other prominent Palestinian speakers, writers, had previously been banned from Germany because right. Germany had forcibly canceled a conference on Palestine in Berlin. And so I hadn't tried to travel to Germany, but apparently there was some entry in the Schengen information system with my name. The Swiss saw it. They asked me a couple of questions. After a brief delay, they let me enter Switzerland. There was no problem. I went to my hotel in Zurich. I had dinner with my hosts at the nearby restaurant. And the plan was the next morning, one of my hosts, Swiss man, would meet me at the hotel and we would walk together to the venue where we were going to have the event the next day, which was a Saturday. Now, already things started happening that Friday night that I'd arrived in Switzerland. Very hostile articles appeared in one of the major newspapers there, the NZZ. And the school where we were supposed to have the event the next day, they canceled
on Friday.
So on Friday, I think we were informed. The organizers were informed either on Friday or early on Saturday that the school had withdrawn its permission to use its auditorium, and so the organizers then had to find an alternative venue, which they did. It was a sort of an alternative space in Zurich where events are held. And so my host came in the morning, and it was quite an uncharacteristically warm January day. So we decided to walk, a very beautiful walk through Zurich. And it was just so normal. I mean, you couldn't have imagined that police or secret police were following us or tracking us. I mean, it just, you wouldn't think anyone knew who we were. We were just people walking in the street. And that at a certain point when we were approaching the venue, somebody just, a big man just grabbed me by the neck. And we were sort of in a pedestrian underpass. So I thought I'm being robbed, which has never happened to me before. But that's what I thought, because this thuggish guy grabbed me by the neck. And then suddenly I felt several more people grabbing me. And I started fighting, but not because I made some brave decision to fight. It was pure instinct. You know, I've never been in a situation like that. And you're just like, a cat trying to get free. And they just overpowered me and they dragged me and they threw me in the back of an unmarked car. And they sped off and they left my host. He was just stunned. You know, I mean, he couldn't believe what was happening, nor could I. And they sped off at high speed and they took me to the Zurich prison where I learned that I had been arrested. I was able to call a lawyer who I had made arrangements with previously. I mean, I'd been in contact with her just because of the issue with Germany. We were just concerned that there would be some issue at the airport. Never imagined anything like this would happen. She came to the prison. There was some sort of strange hearing. I didn't really understand the proceedings very well. But what I understood is they told me several times that you have violated the Swiss law. And I kept asking them, how have I violated the Swiss law? Like, can you tell me what I've done? And recall at this point, I haven't, you know, I'd arrived the night before. The only thing I'd done was have dinner with my host, a private dinner in a restaurant. I hadn't spoken publicly. I hadn't given any media interviews. I'd entered the country legally. They couldn't tell me how I'd violated the Swiss law. But what they did say is that there was a decision that if I were to speak in Switzerland, if I were to speak in Zurich, it could incite violence against Jews. That's what they told me. So it was this very incoherent story. On the one hand, it was a preventive detention to stop me from potentially inciting violence against Jews, which is, of course, something I would never do. And on the other hand, I was told I'd broken the law, but I was never informed how I had broken the law. What had I done? What was my crime? I never knew. They then told me that I was going to be detained. I didn't understand for how long. And they put me, to my shock, you know, it was a very strange experience. You know, after this so-called hearing, my lawyer had to leave. They took me. They put me in a cell. They made me remove all my clothes and put on a prison outfit. And they took me to a cell with a heavy metal door, no communications. I was not allowed to contact my family. I had come from Amman in Jordan, where the same day I left to Switzerland, I flew in the evening first to Istanbul. So that very evening, my mother, who since passed away just a few months ago, but at that time she had been in the hospital. I was very worried about her. I almost canceled the trip to Switzerland because I didn't want to leave her. But my father said, no, she's fine. She, you know, they let her go back home. And I told the prison guards, I said, you know, can I at least just call my mother? They said it's not allowed, which is actually against the law, because I it turns out I was entitled, but they denied those basic rights. And, you know, I was kept in the cell for 3 days. I was not permitted to leave the cell at any time. I was held with a young man there who, you know, I suppose we kept each other company, but he slept most of the time. I was not allowed to contact the lawyer. And finally, after 3 days, I was taken to the airport in handcuffs and in a cage inside a van and put on a plane and sent out of the country. I had no idea. Yeah.
I can't believe that Switzerland did something like that. I mean, when I read about it, it's so utterly unimaginable for me that my country does something like that to you. It makes my stomach turn, and it makes my stomach turn even more now. But so, were you ever given then an explanation while this happened? When they put you on a plane, did they at least tell you what's going on?
We were given, I mean, this gets into the legal aspect, so I'll tell you the recent decision, and then, that will become clear. So, what they did apparently after I entered Switzerland was they issued an entry ban after I had entered, and then they issued an expulsion order. And these were done by FedPol, which is the federal police agency. But these were based on a request from the Zurich Canton. I mean, you obviously know, but for listeners, Switzerland is the federal system like the United States or Canada. So you have the cantons, which would be like the states in the US or the provinces in Canada. And then you have the federal government. So the Zurich Canton, because immigration and entry and exit is a federal issue. So the Zurich Canton, the day before, or 2 days before I arrived in Switzerland, the Zurich Canton had sent a request to FedPol, to the federal government, saying, "We have heard that Ali Abunehmeh is coming to Zurich to take part in these events. And we think this is very dangerous, and we are asking for FedPol to issue an entry ban and to prevent him from entering Switzerland." That was 2 days before I arrived. The next day, FedPol responded to the Zurich Canton, and they said, "We've examined," of course, I'm just summarizing what's in the documents. They said, "We've examined your request, and there is no basis for an entry ban, and therefore your request is denied." And what FedPol said in those internal documents is that his views that you object to, the Zurich Canton objects to, are protected by freedom of expression, number one. And number two, there is no, we can't find any reason to say that he's a threat to the internal or external security of Switzerland, which would be the legal basis for issuing an entry ban. And therefore, the request is denied. And notably, now I know much more about these aspects of Swiss law than I ever thought I would know, but the FedPol assessment by law, they have to consult with two other agencies before they issue the decision. The National Intelligence Service, which I think is called NDB by its German initials,
No.
and the Federal Migration Office. And both of them gave written assessments, which we have, of course, because in the course of the legal process, we have all these documents through the discovery process. The NDB said, "We have no information suggesting this person is a threat." And the Migration Office said the same. So you have the FedPol, the National Intelligence Service, and the Migration Office said, "We have no basis to issue an entry ban."
So up until that point, it seems the system worked the way it is designed. You check on each other if you have any information, and then you the freedom of an US citizen to enter Switzerland is there, so no entry ban whatsoever.
Correct. And therefore, I entered Switzerland legally. It turns out that on the very day I entered, the entry ban was issued after I entered. Now, what happened? We know this now in some detail from number one, the documents that we have, including some internal emails. I believe my lawyers are still trying to determine if we have all the documents, whether anything has been held back, but we have a lot. And the other thing is that in November, the there was a parliamentary committee. It's a special parliamentary committee. I think it's called the Control Committee. It's an audit committee that reviews actions of the federal government. And they also published a report on this case. And what we know is that after this decision by FedPol to reject the entry ban, the next day FedPol reversed that decision and issued the entry ban. But they did so without any new evidence. You know, nothing new came to light. And they did so without any records in the file explaining why the initial lawful and correct decision was reversed. But what the parliamentary investigation found is that the head of FedPol at the time, a woman called Nicoletta Della Valle, made a phone call to the relevant deputy director in FedPol and essentially ordered him to reverse the decision without any basis. And according to the parliamentary report, this intervention was completely improper and counter to the normal procedure, and again was done without any basis whatsoever. And what the parliamentary report says is it raises the possibility of political interference, of improper political interference. And this is significant because Della Valle retired from FedPol a few days after this incident, and very quickly she took a position with a hedge fund called Champel Capital, which is an Israeli hedge fund which invests very heavily in the armaments industry. And its founder is a man called Amir Weitman, who is a member of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party and has been a very outspoken supporter of the genocide in Gaza and of the total expulsion of the Palestinian people from Gaza. And another senior partner of Champel Capital is a former Israeli general called Giora Eiland, who is one of the architects of the so-called general plan, the so-called general's plan, which is a plan, you know, prepared during this ongoing genocide for the total expulsion of the population from Gaza, including through starvation, through, you know, directly targeting the civilian population. And this is the company that immediately hired Nicoletta Della Valle. And this created a scandal even in the Swiss press prior to it being known of her personal role in my arrest. You know, even for the mainstream, quite conservative Swiss press, this was already worrying, and some people were raising the concern, well, you know, as a former senior federal official, Nicoletta Della Valle would have privileged information about Swiss security, potentially Swiss defense contracts and issues, that there would be a conflict of interest, even aside from the political factors. And in addition to that, Nicoletta Della Valle had had publicly been very pro-Israel. So all of this has come out. Now, in terms of the court process, the legal process, we have filed a number of cases in Switzerland. The first one was against my detention as such, the fact that I was held in the prison. And in December, the administrative court in Zurich ruled completely in our favor on every point. And they ruled that my arrest and detention were illegal in terms of Swiss law, unconstitutional in terms of the Swiss constitution. This was an arbitrary deprivation of my liberty, that I was never informed of the reasons for my arrest, that there was no lawful basis for my arrest. And I think even more significantly, it was a violation of the European Convention on Human Rights. So I hope that this has a wider significance. In addition to that, we filed appeals in the federal court in Switzerland against the entry ban and the expulsion order, and those judgments could come at any time. We haven't received them yet. They could come any day. And we have filed criminal charges with respect to a number of individuals, including most recently Nicoletta Della Valle, for abuse of office for the actions that she took in the case. So that's where we stand now. And, you know, for me, what does this come down to? It's not so much, it's not about me alone. It's about fighting back. Again, yes, it is about my rights, but it's about fighting back against the growing censorship and repression across the West in general, but in particular, anyone who criticizes Israel or who talks about the genocide and the complicity of all these governments, including, by the way, the Swiss government in this genocide. We have to fight back against that and have accountability if we are to preserve anything of our so-called democracies, and if we are to preserve the space for us to have even these kinds of conversations that we're having now.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I must thank you, really thank you, for picking up that fight after A, what Switzerland did to you, but B, also like what this means for the entire system. Because what we are learning through your case, and why this was so unbelievable to me, is that this is, it's possible to do that. I thought it wouldn't be, you know, when you tell me that in another country where I don't know how the system works, that somebody can be arbitrarily detained, I would believe that, okay, they're either some people are able to abuse the system, or they're able through corruption or whatnot to go around it. I thought that was not the case for Switzerland, that, you know, the proper way of doing things according to the administrative process and the legal process was a given. Your case shows no, it's not. So what it also shows that, okay, the legal way of doing things, you were in the right, you had the right to be there, and the state should have protected that right. What some criminal individuals managed to do is to circumvent that, and through direct phone calls and probably abuse of office, then have others who should have known better go along and do this kind of very this horrible abuse to you. I mean, I still need to understand how come that four or five police officers would think that it is okay to grab somebody by the neck and throw them into a van. I mean, what were they told what you were doing? What were they told who they are dealing with? I mean, that sounds like what you're doing for like the worst types of drug dealers or whatnot, who you would think would try to stab them back or whatnot, whatever. But so this kind of abuse of the system is possible, and very worryingly have very close connections to foreign governments, a foreign government, and that is then a motivation for this person to even De La Valle to then get a new job. I mean, this is, I don't want to accuse anyone of anything, especially not since this case is going on, but this is extremely worrisome of how money,
well,
what money can do.
It is, from what we know, it is very worrisome. And, you know, I've said what I know and how things appear to me, but I would like the Swiss justice system to investigate things fairly and determine the facts. And maybe that's the good news here, that the court in Zurich delivered a very good judgment. The Parliamentary Audit Committee produced a very thorough report. And so that gives me some confidence that there is, you know, a system in Switzerland still that can get to the truth. So that's all I ask for. I don't ask for anything more than that. But one aspect that I want to mention that I think adds to the worrying aspect of the story is that, because you said, what were they told about who I was, who they were dealing with? I felt like they thought they were dealing with a very dangerous person. Mm-hmm. And What happened during my detention in the prison, as I mentioned, I wasn't allowed out of the cell. I learned only afterwards that we were supposed to have 1 hour a day of exercise outside. We were never given that. So we were in the cell 24 hours a day. But the morning after I spent the first night in the prison, they came to the cell, they opened the little window in the big metal door, and they said, "You have a meeting with the police. We have to take you there." I said, "What's it about? And is my lawyer there?" They said, "We don't know. We just have to take you. You know, they're just the prison wardens." They said, you can ask them. I said, okay, so I'll go with you. So we went, and we get to this office, and I thought, okay, if there's an interview with the police, they have to call my lawyer to come back, right? This is a basic right. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'll go, at least now I'll be able to see my lawyer, because I've been asking and they won't let me. So I went with them, and we reached an office, and there was a man there who greeted me in Arabic, and I thought he was the interpreter. And I'll tell you why I thought that, which gives you another little insight into how things are in Switzerland and in Europe more generally. On the first day when I was, so going back to the first day when I was arrested, and I was allowed to have the lawyer present for this hearing, They said, by law you have to have we have to conduct the proceeding in German, and so we have to have an interpreter. Do you prefer English or Arabic? I said, I don't mind. You can have either. They said, okay, good, because it's the weekend and it's much easier for us to get an Arabic interpreter.
Really?
Okay. And it turns out the reason for that is practically everyone in the prison is either an Arab or an African. I mean, that, so they have a large pool available of
professional Arab interpreters.
Yeah. But it turned out that on the first day they got an English interpreter. The next morning when they took me to this meeting, there was an Arabic man. I thought, okay, it's the weekend. They only found an Arabic interpreter who was on call. So he greeted me in Arabic, and I said, are you the interpreter? He said, no. He said, please come in and we'll explain. And there were two men there, one Swiss, so you're a Swiss-German man, and this Arabic-speaking man, Egyptian dialect speaking man. And they were being very nice to me, and they had bottles of San Pellegrino water, or maybe some fine Swiss mineral water on the table. And they asked me, do you want tea, do you want coffee? I told them, I don't want anything, I would like to see my lawyer, is she on her way? They said, no, this doesn't involve your lawyer. I said, what do you mean it doesn't involve my lawyer? They said, well, we're not from the police. We're from the Swiss Defense Ministry.
What?
Yeah. And I said, what do you have to do with anything? They said, well, we just want to come and talk to you and see if we can help you. I said, well, if you want to help me, you can release me, because I don't know why I'm here. They said, no, well, we just want to see if we talk to you, maybe we can solve the problem and help you. I said, I don't know what the problem is. I don't know why I'm here. I'm a political prisoner. And they said, well, we just want to ask you questions about why you're in Switzerland.
They were trying to extract information from you?
Yeah. I mean, this is what it, without my lawyer. So I kept insisting. I said, I'm not going to talk to you without my lawyer. I have a right to have a lawyer present. And they said, well, this doesn't involve your lawyer. We just want to talk to you. They kept saying it like that. And I said, are you going to call my lawyer or not? They said, no. I said, well, take me back to the cell. I mean, in short, I was more angry than that. But when they took me back to the cell, that was the moment I thought, I really thought about Julian Assange. I literally thought about him. I thought, they want to find something to accuse me of, because the day before they said, if I speak, I'm going to incite violence against Jews, I'm going to incite extremism. I really fear, I was in fear that they are going to invent something to accuse. They told me the day before, you violated the law, without telling me what my violation was. I interpreted this meeting as now they want to find a pretext,
yeah,
to say, you know, to fight, to extract something from me so they can say, aha, he admitted to something.
Did they ever tell you their names?
The Swiss man, he introduced himself as Hoffman. The Egyptian man or Egyptian speaking man, if he gave me his name, I never remembered it. I don't recall it. I only remember Hoffman.
This is so bizarre. This is so bizarre.
And I learned later, I didn't know this at the time, but I learned after my release and after I spoke to the lawyers and so on, that the Swiss intelligence service, by the way, which 2 days before said they don't have any information about me, that the Swiss intelligence service falls under the Swiss defense ministry.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So our assumption is that these were from the Swiss intelligence.
Yep.
But, you know, I didn't agree to talk to them, so I don't know what they, you know, what the angle was. But I was in fear at that point that they want to invent some pretext to detain me or charge me with a crime, because they had told me I violated the law without saying what I'd done.
And you never got the documents, because since this happened inside the prison, there must be records about this and who these people are, because they obviously need to register all of that. And you're right.
Yeah, to my knowledge, I don't think we've received the documents relating to that element. I think, I don't want to misspeak, but I think my lawyers are still taking steps to try to determine whether we have or have not received all of the documents.
I can second your suspicion. Probably these people were working for the Nachrichtendienst, so our spy agency. I had a friend who used to work for them, and she told me that they were told to only identify as working for the ministry. Period. So that would make a lot of sense. That's extremely worrying. So now, though, the courts are telling you that you were in your rights and your rights have been violated. Were you given any compensation for what happened to you so far?
Not yet. Well, yes, the court, the Zurich Administrative Court, ordered the canton to pay my legal costs, which is, I think, about 9,500 Swiss francs. My understanding is that the decision will become final after 30 days, because that's the period in which the canton could appeal if they want to appeal. And once it's final, then we can apply for compensation. So that will come. I mean, the compensation is not, from what I understand, these are not, you know, these are relatively symbolic amounts of money, which I will donate to directly to support people in Gaza. But it's the principle, and, you know, we will pursue that process.
What worries me so much is that all of this seems so coordinated and so prepared. Again, also the articles, and I do remember how I read either on Sunday when you were in prison or on Monday when they had to release you, these articles, including interviews with the head of, what was he at the time, the head of the canton of Zurich's Ministry of Justice?
Mario Fer. He's still in that role, yeah.
He's from my party, Social Democratic Party, of which I'm a paying member, and I'm so mad at these people.
I think now he's independent officially.
Awesome.
But he was a member of that party. And the files show that he played a role.
He was so gleeful. He was so gleeful at your arrest in that NZZ article that I then read. It's just insane.
Yeah, the files show, and this has already been published, that he played a role. I don't want to speculate more than that, because that will be a matter, hopefully, that will come out through the process. But again, it would be, I think, for the citizens of Zurich, at least for some of them, the ones who care about democratic rights, very worrying if the head of security in Zurich can effectively
conspire,
act as a law unto himself, and that will have to be thoroughly investigated.
And that it is possible within the Swiss system that certain people in high-ranking offices are able to call each other and just circumvent the entire system and have, like, the police crack down on little guys and little girls. I mean, that's something that should not be possible. But can we maybe take it on to the bigger level? Because it tells us something about the genocide. You know, because this genocide is not just the Israelis dropping bombs, US-made bombs on the houses of Palestinians in Gaza. It's an entire system in which the West and the different parts of the West are very well integrated. And what happened to you, to me, is just like one part of the system that at the other end then produces the genocide. Because what it tries to do to you is to silence and intimidate and get rid of, well, prominent voices.
Yeah, and it has to be seen in the context of what's happening in the UK with Palestine Action and journalists who have been questioned, journalists and prominent politicians, you know, outside the mainstream, who have been stopped and questioned under the Terrorism Act. My own colleague, Esau Winstanley, the Electronic Intifada, who lives in London, the police raided his home and confiscated his laptop and his phones. He went to court and he actually won the warrant for that search was illegal. That's still in the courts. He could be charged. Activists have been charged. That's in the UK. We see that across Europe, in Germany. I was banned. Dr. Hassan Abu Sitta, the prominent surgeon who was in Gaza for the first weeks of the genocide, performing emergency surgeries on children who are torn apart by these Israeli bombs, was banned from Germany. Later on, the Germans issued an order, what did they call it? Betätigungsverbot, against me, saying that that if I addressed an audience in Germany via YouTube, in other words, from the United States, but I spoke to an audience via Zoom in Germany, I was subject to a fine and up to 1 year in prison.
Yeah, they did the same for Yanis Varoufakis. It's insane.
It's insane. And then in France, of course, you have demonstrations being banned. You have associations being raided. On January 7th this year, a feminist bookstore in Paris, this was published in the French press, in Le Monde, a feminist bookstore was raided by armed, masked police and prosecutors looking for a children's coloring book about Palestine, because its title is From the River to the Sea. So that's the context. You know, this is my story, is my experience of what is a much broader phenomenon across the West. And of course, the United States, the head of the empire, where there is very extreme censorship, it's done in a different way. It's not, well, now it is done by the government, because, you know, it's being done against non-citizens very directly by the government, permanent residents, people like Mahmoud Khalil, who was imprisoned, the students who are being deported. Not quite yet against citizens, but that may be coming. You know, this government makes clear that they want to do that if they can find a way to get away with it. But the censorship in the United States is because we have the First Amendment and it's a very strong constitutional protection, it has to be done through other indirect means. And so it's done through university administrations, through corporations, through media, who punish speech by firing academics, by suspending students and so on. So the censorship is as extreme in the United States. It's just done through a slightly different mechanism.
It tells us though that this kind of very heavy-handed repression, even in Switzerland, is actually necessary to keep the genocide going, right? If it wasn't for these mechanisms, you don't have support on the ground. You know you have 60-70% of people who do not want this level of destruction. Even the ones who do think that October 7th excuses anything that comes after it. I mean, there's just the protests in the United States have been massive, and in Europe actually too. And we've seen how in Europe in certain countries like Spain and Ireland, in Ireland first and foremost, the mood changed immediately toward opposition of the genocide. Right?
And even in the United States. We have a historic shift in the United States. I've been watching these things very closely for 30 years. For the first time consistently since October 7th, we see majorities of the entire American population opposed to Israel. That's unprecedented. You know, in the last decade we saw, or a bit more, we saw shifts that with certain sectors of the population became very pro-Palestinian. But now we have the population overall, a majority expressing negative views about Israel, expressing horror at what it's doing. And those sorts of criticisms were traditionally associated with the sort of left liberal side of American politics. Now that's making inroads, very strong inroads into the right, to the point where it's a major division in the so-called MAGA movement, mm-hmm. and in the Republican Party. These are historic shifts that are happening, and that's the U.S. So in Europe, it's even more uniform. Even in Switzerland, I've received nothing but support from Swiss people who are just utterly horrified. So that gives you a sense of how detached the ruling elites are from where people stand.
Is this maybe, you know, as a hopeless optimist, I always look for silver linings. Is this one of them, that actually, you know, the situation has been so appalling, so bad, but and so publicly, like openly bad, with a Zionist regime that even says we want to exterminate these people and get rid of them, and the more that we kill, the better. I mean, they say that. It's on record. It's not hidden anywhere. Is it at the point where really, like, it's so unignorable that it will lead to a shift in one way or another?
You know, the optimistic side, which I share, is that I think global public opinion, you know, already it was there in what you might call the global south or the third world or whatever. Now the so-called first world or the West or whatever you want to call it has joined the rest of the world in terms of public opinion in utter horror at Israel's crimes and other crimes that the West has been perpetrated, you know, the endless wars, the invasions and so on, which are not stopping, by the way.
Yeah.
The depressing part is, what is the mechanism to translate that into an actual change, into an actual transformation? Because all of this is happening with, like, you know, we know elections don't change policies. You know, you can vote for your Social Democratic Party or your Conservative Party or whatever it is, whether it's in Germany or Switzerland or the UK or anywhere in Europe or in the US. It doesn't change the policies. I mean, well, in the US, you could say we have some kind of radical break, but it's not that radical. If you take the example of the recent regime change attempt in Iran, the latest one, you saw that all of these Democrats who are, you know, night and day against Donald Trump, totally aligned with him when it came to Iran. totally aligned with, you know, demonizing the so-called the regime, as they call it, you know, spreading the narrative that, you know, this is just a popular revolution of oppressed people, and totally ignoring the open role of Israel and U.S. intelligence and European intelligence in fomenting a crisis in Iran and so on. So they're all on the same side. And now you see in this crisis over Greenland, which is just exposing everything, that, you know, Donald Trump is doing us a favor by exposing these text messages from the European leaders. And they're saying, look, we're aligned with you when it comes to Venezuela and Iran or Syria, whatever it is. We just don't want you to do that to us.
Yeah.
You had Mark Rutte, the NATO chief, saying, you know, we support you on Gaza, which means we support the genocide. We have Emmanuel Macron, the French president, saying, I'm with you on Syria. You're doing great things in Syria, great things in Ukraine. It's just Greenland. So they're saying, you know, we're fine, we're happy, we want to be with you in exploiting and oppressing and subverting the rest of the world. But, you know, you can't do that to us. Yes, we will support sanctions that destroy the lives of Syrians, Iranians, that starve Gazans, that starve Yemen. But how dare you put tariffs on us for political purposes?
Tens of millions of people. And you know, the death of millions is acceptable to them. And they put it into a text message saying this is fine. And it is so ironical that it takes a Donald Trump to actually unmask that. I still don't understand the thinking process. I guess he wants to humiliate these people. But in the process, like, exposes the entire thought process of this colonial, still colonial, like, 19th century colonial type of mindset that still rules supreme all over the West. It's quite mind-boggling.
Yeah, and the thing is, so what do we do with all that? This is in the open, but what mechanisms do we as ordinary citizens in all of these countries have? And I think that's the challenge that faces us all. We don't have good answers, because the past, you know, 30 years has meant the dismantling of the mechanisms through which people generally organize collectively, trade unions, mass-based political parties, rather than, you know, these professional corporate-like parties. None of that exists anymore in the West, and therefore, you know, we're left with tweeting about it on social media. We do see some, I don't want to be totally pessimistic, we do see some, you know, mobilizations in the United States in the face of the raids by ICE, the immigration police, the gross abuses and so on. But is it at the scale of the crisis? I don't think so.
The question is always one of political instruments. I mean, one instrument we do have in Switzerland would be a public referendum. We could demand one. We could actually write an article for the Swiss Constitution that forbids any kind of economic interaction with Israel. That would be on the cards in Switzerland. But most countries don't have such direct democratic rights. Which then boils down to mass protests. That's the only thing that can sway government policy when things get so bad that even the elites have to change the approach.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to go back to your earlier point, the repression, the sort of the naked repression, which, I mean, The marketing of the so-called West was always like, well, you can complain about, you know, maybe we're not perfect, but the one thing that for us is absolutely sacred is free speech, your democratic rights. That's what distinguishes us from everyone else. That's our strength. Well, when that's gone, what is there? And I mean, it's even worse, you know, with the EU now imposing sanctions on individual journalists and individual citizens, like Jacques Baud, the Swiss former intelligence officer who gives very critical and excellent analysis. I listen to his analysis all the time. Hussein Doru, a journalist in Germany.
German.
Who cannot feed his family because Ursula von der Leyen issued a decree basically taking away all his rights, imposing personal sanctions on him. So we have now this model of where you sanction an entire country or an entire territory. You sanction Iran, Venezuela, Gaza, Iraq, Syria, but now applied to individuals. So you can become an individual Gaza Strip or an individual Venezuela. And your accounts are blocked. Your ability to do business is blocked. You know, the U.S. has been doing that for many years. Now the EU is doing it with apparently no legal recourse. So what is left of the facade of democracy if that's gone?
That's it. I mean, we don't need Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping to come and take away democracy. We're doing it ourselves. We're doing it ourselves in the name of defending democracy. And the people who scream it out the loudest are those who take it away the strongest. But it really takes cases like yours and brave voices and people like you to actually then also talk about this and not be intimidated. So Ali, I thank you from the bottom of my heart as a Swiss that you actually go through the Swiss system and fight that, because we need it. So thank you.
Well, I mean, I think we have to, you know, I have the opportunity and the responsibility to do it, I feel, for a greater cause. It's, as I said, it's not just about my own personal rights, but I think we're fighting a collective battle to defend our freedom. And, you know, you look at channels like yours, publications like mine, the Electronic Intifada, and our channel on YouTube and, you know, other social media. This is where, you know, I'm turning to channels like yours and others who are in this sort of space of independent media and thought as the only places where I can actually get engaged discussion and analysis uncensored. And, you know, the main so-called mainstream media is garbage now. It's propaganda. I mean, yes, it always was, but I'm old enough to remember that it was never quite this bad. And even that, you know, is under threat. I mean, I know your own channel briefly was apparently due to your channel, if I may say, but you were public about it. It was taken down briefly by YouTube.
Yeah.
It might have been, you can say more, a mistake. In other words, the AI did it by mistake, thinking that this was inauthentic content or something. But in a way, that's just so scary.
Yeah, it is. I talked about this in other places. I still think it's a glitch, but even the glitch reveals problems in the political process, right? That need to be, that a multi-$100 billion company like Google should be able to address. But in any way, like, we need to defend these spaces. And you know, the thing about the society is it only works together. So we actually need each other to do this. So again, I would like to thank you, Ali, and people who want to follow you and your work, they should of course go to your homepage, the Electronic Intifada. Is there, and to your X account to follow you there? Is there another place where people should read or listen to you?
That's it. And only when people like you invite me to speak, that's where you'll find me. You won't find me in any mainstream media.
We will certainly have you back on here, and I do hope there will be a point when you will be in mainstream media again. That will be the proof that things are getting better. Ali Abu Nima, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Pascal.